According to a new analysis, at least 10,000 more British children have fallen to poverty since Prime Minister Keir Starmer took office, thanks to the two-child benefit cap. We take a look at some of the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to new research, more than 9 million people in the United Kingdom experience levels of poverty and hunger so extreme that they're vulnerable to reliance on charity food banks. A report by the charity Trussell found Labour would fail to deliver its manifesto promise to remove the moral scar of food banks unless it tackled low household incomes in this group, which amounted to 1 in 7 of the population. The study found there were 1 million more people in what the report defined as hunger and hardship, living on income at least 25% below the relative poverty line than 5 years ago, and nearly 3 million more than there were 2 decades ago. Trussell said the rapid growth in recent years of households in this kind of deep poverty, meaning they regularly struggle to afford food, heating, clothing, and other everyday basics, had driven food bank use to record levels in Britain. The charity's chief executive, Emma Revy, said, "It's 2024 and we're facing historically high levels of food bank need. As a society, we cannot allow this to continue. We must not let food banks become the new norm." Children were at high risk of facing hunger and hardship, with a fifth of all United Kingdom youngsters falling into this category. A third of larger families, those with 3 or more children, were also at high risk of dependency on charity food. Trussell stopped short of calling for the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, to immediately abolish the two-child benefit limit at this month's autumn statement, despite its disproportionate impact on the finances and well-being of larger families. While the charity believes abolishing the two-child limit would cut child poverty levels in larger families, it would do little to immediately address the needs of most people at high risk of food bank use, including many disabled people and unpaid carers. Trussell's Director of Policy, Helen Barnard, said, "We know that removing the two-child limit would be a positive step for larger families, and we agree that it is a vital part of addressing this issue. But as indicated by this research, the majority of people who are facing hunger and hardship would not benefit from that one change alone." The Chancellor of the Exchequer is expected in the short term to resist pressure from poverty campaigners and backbench Labour MPs to abolish the two-child limit. The Treasury believes the £3 billion cost of abolishing the much-criticised Tory policy is now unaffordable, given the competing demands for investment across public services. The charity organisation Trussell says fixing the UK's outdated and stingy benefit system is vital to cutting food bank use, and as a first step has called on ministers to protect the income of 2.2 million people whose universal credit income is reduced by monthly deductions for historic loans and debts, and a further 120,000 households hit by the benefit cap. It says this can be achieved by introducing a legal minimum income floor under standard allowance for universal credit. This will restrict the amount that can be clawed back by the state each month. It also calls for uprating of housing benefit rates in line with rents and protection for disability benefits. The study found that most, or 58% of people facing hunger and hardship, were in a household where at least one person is working. Almost 4 in 10 people in households claiming universal credit were in hunger and hardship. Trussell, formerly known as the Trussell Trust, is Britain's biggest food bank network, with more than 1,400 food bank outlets throughout the country. Last year, it gave out a record 3.1 million food parcels. It has pledged to end the need for food banks, arguing they have no place in a so-called advanced society. Labour's 2024 election manifesto promised to end mass dependence on emergency food parcels, which it called a moral scar on British society. It also vowed to overhaul universal credit and introduce a strategy to tackle child poverty. Ian Porter, a senior policy advisor at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, said ministers who have promised to bring poverty down must see these findings as a sign that they can't afford to waste any more time and must take immediate action. The government has a moral obligation in the first budget to relieve the hardship which has become all too widespread in recent years. The website Nursery World has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to new analysis, at least 10,000 more children have fallen into poverty since Prime Minister Keir Starmer took office, thanks to the two-child benefit cap. The policy, which was introduced by George Osborne when he was Chancellor, means low-income parents are denied key benefits, including universal credit, for their third and any subsequent children born from April of 2017. The Labour government has so far resisted pressure to scrap the policy, with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, reluctant to take on the unfunded pledge without citing where the £3 billion annual cost would come from. However, the data from the Child Poverty Action Group lays bare the significant impact of the cap, showing 10,000 children have been pulled into poverty by the two-child benefit limit since the government took office in early July. The charity's chief executive, Alison Garnham, said the clock is ticking while child poverty rises and the two-child limit is the key driver of the increase. Scrapping it is the most cost-effective way to stop more kids being pulled into poverty under government's watch, adding, "We welcome the government's Child Poverty Task Force, but the damage grows every day. The policy must be abolished in the upcoming budget." John McDonnell, who was suspended from the Labour Party for backing a Scottish Nationalist Party amendment that called for the cap to be scrapped, said, "Many of us are pledging with the government to act on this before any more children are forced into poverty by this inequitous rule. No Labour government worthy of the name can stand by and witness children suffering and their lives blighted in this way." Rosie Duffield, who quit the Labour Party recently, said she would have rebelled to vote for the Scottish Nationalist Party amendment to scrap the two-child benefit cap in July, but had COVID. She said, "These new figures should shame every single Member of Parliament. We could and should do what all non-governmental organisations and charities have been asking us to do for the best part of a decade and scrap this heinous and punitive cap that traps children and families in poverty."
Yani.
Bazaar.
No matter where you're from or who you are, one thing that brings people together is a good meal. Everyone has a favorite food. It's a great way to connect with others, experience culture, and explore new flavors. And the food industry caters to our tastes, which is the main driver for the expansion of this sector. The food industry is made up of a complex network of activities related to farming, production, supply, and a host of services and products. So it's no surprise that this sector also plays a significant role in the economic development of any nation. Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. This week, we will venture through Iran's food industry while shining the spotlight on meat production. We wanted to see how the food market is doing and check out the developments in some production areas, such as red and white meat. Plus, we will explore this industry's contributions to the national economy. We wanted to learn more about the journey meat products take to finally reach grocery store shelves and dinner tables. So to become more familiar with food production, we visited a meatpacking business on the outskirts of the capital, Tehran. This particular producer was established 15 years ago and has become a familiar name in the industry. The meatpacking market is composed of many sectors within the market. One of the primary concerns for any company packaging meat is the ability to deliver fresh products to consumers. This can happen in various ways and is heavily dependent on the type of meat that will be packaged. For example, this company has several production halls dedicated explicitly to particular activities, because not all meat comes in the same size or can be handled with the same machine. There are different production halls for each meat type. Red meats, such as lamb and cow, require larger machines and more space, while poultry, such as chicken, require smaller machines comprising closed-circuit production lines. But why does this company use a closed-circuit production line? This ensures the meat passing through each stage is kept cool and free of foreign contaminants. More importantly, such a process guarantees that each item is uniformly cut and packaged while maintaining sanitary conditions crucial for quality and safety. Now, the modern food industry uses a wide variety of sophisticated technologies, making production more efficient. It has also reduced menial human labor, freeing up hands for other, more complex tasks. In case you didn't know, and many don't, Iran has indigenized a lot of technology and machinery needed in the food industry. Moreover, these machines play a crucial role in maintaining food quality and safety. For most companies in the food industry, the high quality output is deeply hinged on the raw material they use. In the case of this company, they use free-range livestock that is pasture-fed from some of the most famous animal-rearing regions of the country. While most meatpacking companies have their own slaughterhouses, this one maintains contracts with livestock farmers who slaughter the animals before sending them to the packing company. The food industry is one of the most heavily regulated sectors in the nation. That is because quality and safety are important aspects for consumers. This company makes its products along the lines of Iran's Food and Drug Administration guidelines and the National Standards Bureau. It has also received international certificates for production and safety, meaning it can easily export its products too. Additionally, this company has created numerous job opportunities for the community while maintaining the highest production standards. What makes a company stand out among others in this highly competitive industry is not only the quality of products, but also the services it provides to its consumers. While the food industry has not been directly sanctioned by the United States, these harsh measures have hindered international banking and money transfers. This means many in this sector cannot import important machine components, which are still not locally manufactured. The basis of the food industry has always been agricultural production. Without the output of this sector, the food industry would not thrive as it does now. That's why Iran has a very robust agrarian industry. But agriculture is not limited to farming alone. It also includes livestock rearing, dairy, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Plus, exports from this strategic industry have also generated millions in foreign revenues, contributing to the national economy. First, let's look at the country's meat production as a whole. Based on the National Livestock Exporters Assembly, domestic needs for red meat roughly stands at 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, the country had 72 million heads of these animals, meaning 12 million were surplus and could be used for various exports. According to official figures, this year, 51,000 tons of red meat were produced up to the month of May alone. However, not all livestock are raised for their meat. They are also used for dairy production. Looking at statistics from Iran's Customs Administration, roughly $800 million of raw milk is exported annually. Next, we have the agriculture sector, which mainly produces raw materials for other food production. Data from the Customs Administration shows that some 7 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported last year. This amount was worth nearly $5 billion and reveals an 8% growth in export values compared to 2020. Looking more closely at these exports, around half of this revenue was raked in by 10 major agricultural products. The undisputed king of all agricultural exports is saffron, which brought $1 billion in trade. Next came pistachios, valued at $540 million, followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of value. All right, now is the time for me to take a little break here and give the floor to my good friend out in the field who has prepared a report for us.
What's going on, guys? Well, actually, it's been a while that I've been looking for a practical pair of shoes, and today I decided to come to the first and oldest industrial shoe producer in Iran and the biggest distributor in the Middle East. Looking around, I can see a wide range of shoes in different colors, and this is what makes it difficult for me to choose the right one. To be honest with you guys, I've always been excited to learn more about the manufacturing process of shoes. For this reason, I asked this company to walk me through the production line of footwear. So don't go anywhere, stay with me. As I promised, guys, now I'm inside of a shoes manufacturer to show behind the scenes of shoemaking. I wanted to step right into the factory to see the production line, but I just realized that every little piece has a process here. Now I'm in the designing room, and there's a thing that is called the last of the shoes, and it was really interesting to me to see how the shoes that we wear on a day-to-day basis is turned from to this. Now I'm going to give you an overview of how it is turned into the shoes that we wear. There's tape that is applied on the last, and to draw the design and create the prototype for different collection of shoes. And then it is sent off to the stitching section to cut out the pattern on the necessary materials. And we've got different materials, different leather materials with different patterns and different colors. And finally, after the whole thing is approved to this section, it is sent off to the production line. Partly due to the number of pieces used to make one shoe, constructing footwear is a true craft. The pieces needed to make the shoe are cut from high-quality leather, then next in the shoe manufacturing process comes stamping. In the factory, there are various departments that each performs different stages of the production process. When a department has finished their role, the soles are forwarded to the next department in line. Right off from the designing section, they get here into the production line, and all the pieces are die-cutted. They are cut into different pieces to finally send them for gluing and stitching to ensure all the pieces are stuck together. Shoe manufacturing involves numerous steps to put all the pieces together. Assembling the shoe is the step in the production where the magic happens. Here, all the pieces, including the one that was just sewn, are fitted to form finished shoes. During assembling, the upper is bonded to the outsole. But before this happens, the insole is attached to the last and the upper ridge is placed on the insole to allow the shaft to be stitched to the wet later on and finally give the shoe its final shape. Do you really think it's simple? It is not as simple as you think. It is such a demanding job. I call this stage the birth of the shoes because the pairs of the shoes are taken off from the mold to finally move on to the final stage, which is trimming. I'm gonna give him these shoes, and what he does is cutting out the edges of the shoes to be completely trimmed and sent to the other guy for buffing, waxing, and polishing off the shoes. And finally, they are nice and shiny, and they are ready to be boxed up and shipped out to customers all across the country. Well, what is so significant about this company is the durability and the guarantee of its shoes over time. So for this reason, I was so curious to see what the secret is behind this quality. Now, I'm in the quality control sector to see what happens exactly. All right, what happens here is after the shoes sampling are approved, they are sent off, like different parts of the shoes are sent off from the production sector to this quality control sector. And there are several machines that each of them does is dedicated to a specific style of shoes. For example, formal shoes, athletic shoes, children's shoes. But now, what is so exciting, I'm going to walk you through, or I'm going to draw your attention to the safety shoes. Can you ever imagine a 20 kilogram weight falling in a horrifying manner on your shoes? That is something beyond my imagination. So I want to tell you today that this is the machine. It is called the impact tester that does the same thing. So let's zoom in and see what happens exactly. But of course, it's super horrifying. So I need to keep my distance. Wow, what a sound. You see, it's really, it's like a horror movie, the sounds that I listen, that I hear in the movies. So you need to keep your distance. And the final thing, mold, it is placed at the front side of the shoes. And what is the concept of this machine? Since the front of the shoes needs to be fully backed for workers who have demanding jobs in harsh conditions, this machine was created to, form or place mold in the front of the shoes to protect workers from any sort of damages. So this is really mind-boggling, and it's really a lot to get my mind around. By the end of the day, around 1,400 types of footwear are sold extensively in this company's chain stores. This wide range offers various styles for people of all ages in the society, such as men, women, kids, sports, and as I showed you earlier, safety shoes. After I took a real-life tour into the footwear production world, I gained a broader perspective on how a single pair of shoes is actually made. Wow, for me it was really amusing to take a look at the behind the scenes of shoemaking. Alright, now I realize that there are so many factors that play a significant role in choosing a standard pair of shoes, such as the raw material, the comfort, the beauty, the design, and the color. What I appreciate most about this company is the fact that it offers a constellation of footwear in various colors. Shoes for men, women, children, and even safety shoes, as I mentioned earlier. And we've got sandals, slippers, and of course in different quality, we've got leather shoes, linen shoes, and just you name it. I hope that you got a better understanding of what a pair of shoes goes through before it reaches into your hands. I've been Sarah Dema.
That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The United States has spent more than $22 billion over the past year on military aid to Israel and on funding Israeli aggression across the region. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Cradle website has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new report, American arms dealers have gathered record profits from Israel's wars on the besieged Gaza Strip and Lebanon. In a report released on Wednesday, 9th of October, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, an American think tank focused on U.S. foreign policy, revealed that U.S. arms manufacturers have outperformed major stock indexes this year, driven by increased arms sales to Israel for its genocidal war in Gaza. According to the report, stock funds invested in the U.S. aerospace and defense industry, including companies like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, RTX, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, and L3Harris, saw profits exceed expectations this year, outperforming the Standard & Poor's 500 index. Responsible Statecraft, the think tank, added, "That handout of taxpayer funds to Israel, coupled with Israel and global demand increasing for weapons in a period of instability, has been jet fuel for stock prices." Findings of the think tank also revealed that Lockheed Martin, the manufacturer of the F-35 fighter jet, utilized by Israel to continuously bombard the Gaza Strip, as well as Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, achieved a total return of 54.86% from October of last year to the same date in 2024, exceeding the Standard & Poor's 500 index by approximately 18%. RTX, the manufacturer of 2,000-pound bunker-busting bombs that have reduced much of Gaza to rubble and are currently being deployed in Beirut, Lebanon, reported a total return of 82.69% for investors over the past year, surpassing the Standard & Poor's 500 index by approximately 46%. Both Lockheed Martin and RTX shares reached all-time highs on Tuesday, 8th of October, while L.T. Harris and Northrop Grumman tallied their top share price since 2022. The report added General Dynamics, known for producing bunker-busting bombs and the BLU-109 bombs used by Israel to demolish several apartment buildings in southern Beirut during the assassination of Hezbollah Secretary General Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, gained a total return of 37% for investors, exceeding the Standard & Poor's 500 index by just over 3 percentage points. Additionally, the iShares U.S. Aerospace and Defense Fund, managed by BlackRock and tracking the aerospace and defense sector, reached a new all-time high recently, increasing its 12-month gain to 43% and outperforming the Standard & Poor's 500 index by 33%. A report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, says from 2019 to 2023, Israel represented 2.1% of total global arms imports. During this time frame, the United States supplied 69% of Israel's arms imports, while Germany provided 30%. While Washington continues to be a dominant player in the global arms market, accounting for 42% of global arms sales, it has also marked increased its military expenditures to support Israel, exceeding $23 billion within a single year. The Middle East Eye has covered the same story, but from a different angle. The United States has spent more than $22 billion on military aid to Israel and on funding Israeli aggression across the region over the past year. According to a new report published by Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, the United States has given Israel $17.9 billion in military aid since the onset of the Gaza genocidal war in October of last year. In inflation-adjusted dollars, this marks the highest amount of military aid to the Israeli regime. The figure surpasses U.S. military aid to Israel during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. The Middle East Eye said the dollar figure is almost nearly quadruple the amount given to Israel in the 1980s during its war against the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, in Lebanon. And its 15-year occupation of Lebanon and its 2006 war against Hezbollah. According to the report, the aid to Israel includes military financing, weapons sales and transfers from U.S. weapons stockpiles. The report highlights how U.S. taxpayer dollars given to Israel as part of military aid have surged in the past year. However, the report's authors caution the figure is incomplete, citing the U.S. administration's efforts to hide the full amounts of aid and types of system through bureaucratic maneuvering. The authors of the report said the figure of $17.9 billion in U.S. security assistance to Israel from October of last year to September of 2024 is a fraction of the full value of U.S. support for this war, which will only be determined over time. The report also noted that the United States has spent an additional $4.86 billion funding pro-Israel operations in the Middle East region, including in Yemen, since the Gaza war started. Since the onset of the war, the Yemeni forces have carried out scores of operations in support of war-hit Gazans, striking targets throughout the occupied Palestinian territories, in addition to targeting Israeli ships or other vessels heading towards ports in the occupied Palestinian territories. The United States and the United Kingdom have been carrying out strikes against Yemen after the Biden administration and its allies offered the Tel Aviv regime unqualified support and said Yemeni forces bear the consequences of their attacks against Israeli-owned ships or merchant vessels heading to the occupied Palestinian territories. The unwavering support of the United States for Israel came despite opposition from some American officials, lawmakers, and many human rights groups concerned about the killing of civilians in Gaza, as well as civilians in the West Bank of the River Jordan and in Lebanon. Former U.S. government officials, including former members of the U.S. State Department and former members of the U.S. military, said in a joint statement in July, America's diplomatic cover for and continuous flow of arms to Israel has ensured our undeniable complicity in the killings and forced starvation of besieged Palestinians in Gaza. Israel launched its brutal war on Gaza on 7th of October last year. The regime's bloody onslaught on Gaza has so far massacred more than 42,000 Palestinians, many of them women and children, and injured nearly 100,000 others. Thousands have been listed as missing or presumed dead underneath the rubble. Israel has also been targeting Lebanon recently. Lebanon's Islamic Resistance Movement Hezbollah has been responding to the Israeli aggression with numerous retaliatory operations. According to Lebanon's health ministry, more than 2,000 people have been martyred as a result of Israeli attacks on Lebanon in the past year.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The main market in the city of Khan Yunis, where people come every day in search of food they can afford to satisfy their hunger. Famine has again returned here as Israel continues to block crossings and restrict the entry of aid and basic necessities in the southern parts. This, as Israel repeatedly says, is thus the safe haven for those remaining in the besieged north.
I have been displaced here since May. And let me say that the situation here in the south is no better than in the north. We lack basic needs such as food, flour, and vegetables. Do you see this tomato? I can't even afford this one tomato, as the prices of available items and vegetables are astronomical. We receive no aid as the crossings are closed. It would cost us a fortune to get one decent meal.
With the market shelves and vendors empty except for a few items available at astronomical prices, the Gazans find themselves looking for whatever they can afford to satisfy their hunger, even if it was rotten bread.
We were displaced from Jabalia because we were told that the situation here in the south was better. But we have been struggling every day for more than a year in search of food to feed our children. We can barely find any flour to make some bread. I wish we had stayed in the north and never left.
According to the United Nations World Food Programme, the ongoing crisis could escalate into famine. But Gazans say this is the least that could be said to describe the situation here. What is happening is systematic starvation to kill those who survive the bombardments.
My son asked this morning to make him some salad. Can you imagine? He just asked for a salad, and I couldn't fulfill his wish because we can't afford vegetables. They are scarce and extremely expensive. I own this vendor, but there is nothing to sell because products are banned and people can't afford what is available. And they certainly do not receive aid as Israel prevents it.
Whether in the north of Gaza or here in the south, Palestinians continue to struggle to secure a decent meal for their children. This daily suffering persists while Israel's genocides claim their lives without allowing them the dignity of dying without hunger. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
Yemen's naval forces are creating their own parting of the Red Sea to help liberate Palestinians from Israel's genocide in Gaza. The maritime divide by Yemen aims to block vessels linked to Israel while allowing those without ties pass unhindered. According to military officials, Israeli-linked companies are currently trying to fabricate digital data and information to hide their association with Israel so they can pass Yemeni waters.
The Zionists are trying to deceive the world by using unlawful tactics to change the ownership names of vessels and companies associated with them. This will not work. We have enough information, and we know all the names and companies linked to the Zionist entity.
Through advanced data-gathering methods, Yemen's ground and naval forces are equipped to take precise actions against vessels engaging in deceptive practices.
Yemen's intelligence and security have reached advanced capabilities. We can obtain any information we want from any source. All information is then submitted to decision makers, who make informed final decisions.
The Red Sea, a strategic yet contested waterway, has become an advantage point for Yemen as they intercept potential threats and block Israeli-linked vessels from advancing undetected. Officials emphasized that fortified naval defenses serve as a crucial line of resistance against covert U.S. and Israeli incursions.
Yemeni territorial waters are considered to be the most strategic yet vulnerable access point the enemy could use against Yemen. Therefore, it was a top priority to advance our naval capabilities, and now these waters have become our strongest weapon, which we are using against the enemy.
Yemen's operations in the Red Sea are specifically aimed at pressuring Israel to end its genocide in Palestine, as well as its military offensive in Lebanon.
Yemen's armed forces say they are now in a stronger position than ever to continue anti-Israel operations in the Red Sea and even beyond. Meanwhile, it seems that Yemen will need to rely more on intelligence gathering in order to continue these calculated naval operations. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Nasruddin Amir, the head of the Yemeni Sabah news agency, revealed that the United States had messaged Ansarullah leaders seeking permission for an American aircraft carrier to pass through the Red Sea without incident. However, according to Amir, that request was outrightly rejected and the aircraft carrier subsequently became a target.
There is American hegemony in the region, and it is historically known that neighboring countries are subject to this hegemony, and we believe that they may join any aggression against Yemen, as they did in previous years, with American support. So far, there is nothing new in the negotiations to stop the war on Gaza and Lebanon, and the American administration lies more than it breathes, and all matters are heading towards escalation, especially with the approach of the Iranian response.
A new statement, Amir claimed that the U.S. and Israel are actively pushing for escalation, aiming to draw other countries in the Middle East into the conflict, a move he warns could ultimately place American interests in jeopardy. He also stated that Yemeni officials have sent multiple warnings to nearby countries, urging them to avoid being drawn into what he called American attempts to widen the war, and warned that participating in this war could have dire consequences.
There is no doubt that if America and Israel wage a war on Yemen, Saudi Arabia and the Emirates will be forced to engage in this war, and this will be done indirectly by supporting and financing Yemeni mercenary factions, supplying them with weapons, and spending on military operations in full because these countries fear appearing in the picture, knowing that Yemen will not hesitate to target them with ballistic and hypersonic missiles.
These remarks come after a recent series of diplomatic meetings led by U.S. Ambassador to Yemen Stephen Vagan, who has reportedly been working to coordinate with Saudi and Emirati-backed factions in Yemen. His efforts aim to ramp up tensions in Hudaydah, a city crucial for Yemen's coastal defense along the Red Sea. Observers say the latest developments are part of a larger pressure campaign by the U.S., Britain and Israel, seeking to push Ansarullah and the Yemeni military into lifting the naval blockade, as well as to halt Yemen's military support for Gaza and Lebanon.
With Ansarullah rejecting U.S. requests and issuing warnings to neighboring countries, the risk of Yemen becoming a battleground grows by the day. How far this escalation will go remains uncertain, but for now, the message from Yemeni officials remains clear. This is a warning to those who would bring the war closer to Yemen's shores. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Polls show Muslim Americans are capable of tipping the balance in the several swing states which will decide the Electoral College, but Vice President Kamala Harris's participation in the Gaza genocide has shocked voters of all types.
There are some elections that are a referendum on a specific question, and the question here is not stopping the right-wing maniac. I don't want Trump in office, but this election is a referendum on Gaza. And I think the anti-war movement and all people that are, you know, standing in horror at the genocide that's going on every hour on our phones, we can watch it. We have to vote. You know, with that in mind, so I cannot vote for the Democrats.
There's no lack of major issues for voters to consider. Record inflation, the failed war in Ukraine, the January 6th rebellion, the alleged political weaponization of the judicial system, COVID, soaring inequality, increased censorship, a deeply divisive Republican candidate in Donald Trump, and much more.
I think that is also a referendum on the issue of inflation and COVID recovery. You know, we're the richest nation in the world, and there were still millions of people that were evicted, millions of people that lost their homes, and everybody has suffered the insurmountable issue of inflation in this country. And I think most people feel, while the administration insists that the numbers are improving, they don't feel that they are, you know, in a comfortable place economically.
Polls show the Republicans are likely to win the upper house of Congress, with the lower house too close to call. A recent poll found 46% of Republicans and 27% of Democrats said they would not consider the vote's outcome to be legitimate if the other party's presidential candidate wins the election, with 14% of Republicans and 11% of Democrats willing to, quote, take action.
For many, it's been a difficult 4 years. For many others, it's been a difficult 8 years. As America heads to the polls, the only certainty seems to be that division, disunity, dissatisfaction, and maybe even dysfunction aren't going away anytime soon. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Showcasing Neuron's latest achievements in optics and its applications in cutting-edge technology, the fifth edition of the International Laser and Photonics Exhibition is an opportunity to display remarkable strides in laser technology and the most recent achievements spanning sectors from medical and industrial applications to environmental solutions. This year's event is significant due to the advancements made despite Western sanctions, as head of Iran's Laser Science and Technology Center explained.
We are certainly ahead in some areas of laser technology. However, in other fields, there are countries that lead the way, especially in research and development. While the harsh sanctions have imposed restrictions on us, they have not halted our progress.
35 companies, including 16 knowledge-based firms, are set to showcase their latest achievements in this year's exhibition.
The exhibition will run from November 3rd to 6th at Iran's International Exhibition Center.
This year, we've brought together participants from diverse fields, including industrial, medical, and knowledge-based sectors. Around 38 booths will showcase their innovations, with private companies, research institutions, and academic centers exchanging knowledge and expertise throughout the event.
Iran's laser technology is proving invaluable to the economy by enhancing production across multiple sectors, from steel manufacturing to high-precision medical operations, all while lowering costs. These advancements position Iran as an emerging player in exports, providing new opportunities for growth across its industries.
Knowledge, by its very nature, drives wealth creation. We focus on knowledge and outcome-oriented research, which we're investing in today, not as an expense, but as a strategic investment. A breakthrough in one area can spark transformative changes across other industries. That's why we view it as an investment, and it truly is.
One of the main highlights of this year's exhibition will be the fiber laser technology, which compared to the more traditionally used carbon dioxide lasers, operates at up to 6 times the speed, and with maintenance requirements drastically lower, fiber laser presents a more efficient and cost-effective solution for Iran's modern industrial needs.
Lasers with such high output of energy will have unique applications in various industries, marking a significant step towards a greater self-sufficiency despite the ongoing sanctions. Ali Ramazani, Tehran.
Pro-Palestine and pro-Lebanon protests swept across Yemen after Friday prayers, with demonstrators reigniting support for the armed resistance against the Israeli regime in Gaza and Lebanon. The protesters celebrated the appointment of Sayyid Naeem Qassem as Hezbollah's new secretary general, expressing hope that he will lead the Islamic resistance group in Lebanon towards its goal.
We came out today across the country in solidarity with the Axis of Resistance and the appointment of Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General, Sayyid Naeem Qassem. We say to him, carry forward the banner of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. We will support you, and you can always count on us.
We congratulate Hezbollah on the appointment of Sayyid Naeem Qassem as the new leader. We are confident he will carry forward the same message and the same method as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah.
Protesters also expressed a willingness to cross borders and engage in direct combat with Israeli forces. For now, however, Yemen's drones and missiles, including hypersonic missiles, are capable of reaching Tel Aviv in less than 12 minutes.
By Allah, we are very eager to meet the Zionists directly on the battlefield. We are also eager to escalate our military operations against them. Their attacks only make us stronger and more determined.
The Yemeni attacks are calculated to denigrate Israel's economic stability and diminish its regional influence. As the conflict escalates, Yemen's forces continue to employ advanced military capabilities, challenging Israel and the West. Another Friday of pro-Palestinian protest took place across the country after a series of military operations by Yemen's armed forces against Israeli interests across the region. The leader of Ansarullah says if the U.S. is unable to stop Yemen's military operations in the Red Sea, no one can. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
On Parliament Square, pro-Palestine activists hoisting the Palestinian flag and a banner that says it all.
Gaza must have food and water. The bombs must stop. We must stop arming Israel. They've got no right to do what they're doing. It's inhuman.
Days earlier, members of the Women Rising Coalition lined over 700 baby vests on Parliament Square in a powerful tribute to Gaza's thousands murdered infants. While the members of the parliament may look the other way, members of the public boldly manifest their solidarity.
Well, they have been protesting here every day across from the British Parliament for more than a week now. Their aim, as ever, they say, is to make the politicians inside confront the reality of their continued support for Israel.
In September, the new Labour government suspended a fraction of its arms sales to Israel, a move described by campaigners as an admission of guilt and a half-hearted gesture that will do nothing to end Israel's war crimes in Gaza.
This is aiding and abetting the war crimes, and history will tell that. They will be tried at the end of their at the end of serving, because it's just so obvious what's happening.
Stop funding war crimes!
The five independent MPs in Parliament are echoing the demand being made here and by two-thirds of Britons. How long will the government that promised change be able to resist those calls? Saeed Purza, London.
Rights groups, unions, civil society organizations, and members of the public have gathered at Belfast City Hall to highlight the urgent need for Northern Ireland to establish hate crime legislation, as it is the only region in the UK without such measures.
There are families across the city and across Northern Ireland who are living in fear right now because of racist attacks, because simply they have become targets because of their skin colour, their nationality, their religion, their immigration status.
Muslim organisations and pro-Palestinian groups participated in the protest to support calls for accountability given the West's role in regional conflicts, including Israel's ongoing atrocities.
Well, we need to push UK government and America, because these are the two governments who are supporting the Zionist regime and give them the weapon and the political cover. So we need to challenge them. We need to stop that.
There is a demand for stronger protection for minority communities in Northern Ireland, with calls on politicians and police authorities to take action. The region has a growing Muslim population, partly due to wars elsewhere. Campaigners are demanding that more police are recruited in Northern Ireland to better protect those being targeted by far-right thugs. Businesses run by Syrians and Africans have been repeatedly attacked here in Northern Ireland. They come from countries that the West helped to destabilise. And so critics say foreign interference continues to fuel xenophobia, both here in the UK and in the EU. Jerome Hughes, Belfast.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Los afanes hegemónicos.
The hegemonic ambitions of absolute domination by the United States and Western Europe are met with opposition and proposals from the people, from the countries that seek sovereignty and independence. This includes military, political, economic, cultural, and social areas in general. From an economic point of view, some of these countries, which are at odds with the U.S. and Western European hegemony, and yet seek sovereignty and independence, made a bet, joined together, and formed the BRICS.
Estos países.
Countries like Brazil, Russia, India, China, and later South Africa were the base that allowed them to stand up to the economic hegemony of the West.
Permitió pararse frente a la hegemonía económica del Occidente.
Today, the BRICS group has expanded significantly, now comprising 10 nations, the possibility of reaching 50, and 40 more.